I'm Rich Eggeran. This is In the Tri-States, a review of the news of the past month. The elections were the big story in November. President Barack Obama scored a convincing victory to earn a second term as the nation's leader. In the tri-states, Democrat Sherry Bustos received 53% of the vote to unseat Republican Congressman Bobby Schilling in Illinois' 17th district. Bustos said she was ready to get started.
I'm going to call every new member of Congress, whether they be Republican or Democrat. I'll call every single one. We're going to host a retreat and get to know all the new members of Congress on a personal level. So when we start working together, we will have already a relationship built, at least in a small way, so we can get this country moving in the right direction.
In the neighboring 18th congressional district, Republican Aaron Schock easily won another term in office. In southeast Iowa, Democratic Congressman Dave Lobsack pulled off a decisive victory to win a fourth term. In northeast Missouri, the congressman in the region's new district will be Republican Sam Graves, who easily turned aside a challenge from two others. Democratic State Senator John Sullivan of Rushville received 56% of the vote to turn back a challenge from Adams County Republican Randy Fries. In southeast Iowa, Democrat Rich Taylor of Mount Pleasant defeated Republican Larry Cruzy to win the state Senate seat being vacated by longtime Senator Democrat Gene Frazee. An Iowa Supreme Court justice who evangelicals hope to throw off the bench will keep his job after all. Religious conservatives waged a vigorous campaign against retention for Justice David Wiggins because of his vote clearing the way for same-sex marriage. But this year, progressives pushed back. Public Radio's Joyce Russell has the story.
A subdued crowd of religious conservatives watched the votes coming in the justice's favor at a private party in Grimes. The head of the Vote No on Wiggins Project, Bob Vanderplatz, didn't act too surprised that they failed.
We had a lot on our plate tonight that we wanted to advance for the family. Well, I said right from the beginning that this would be an uphill battle.
2 years ago, the evangelicals succeeded in ousting three justices from the bench who were part of the unanimous marriage ruling. This year, a presidential election year, Vanderplatz said the bigger turnout meant more voters to educate, and the Democratic groundswell for President Obama worked against them. The justices' supporters who were holding their watch party across town called the vote a victory for the courts. Cynthia Mosier is president of the Iowa Bar Association, which went to bat for Wiggins.
This is a significant victory, not for the Iowa State Bar Association, but for the citizens of the state of Iowa. I think what happened in 2010 surprised, frankly, many Iowans.
When the evangelicals launched their anti-judge effort 2 years ago, Mosier says the state had gone 50 years without a justice being challenged for retention.
And it was the first time we saw the injection of a partisan political issue, a social agenda, into a judicial retention election.
So this year, the justices' allies were more aggressive in getting the word out that Wiggins was just doing his job when he ruled on gay marriage, and he should be retained. The No Wiggins Project again spent more than the justices' supporters, just as they did 2 years ago. Both sides attracted money from outside the state. One man with a keen interest in the vote was Michael Streit. One of the three justices voted off the bench 2 years ago. Streit says he's pleasantly surprised by the vote on Wiggins.
Yes, it's a fair statement. I was fairly pessimistic that he was going to be able to hold his seat without getting more involved. The voters have done the right thing for Justice Wiggins, so I'm very happy for him.
Wiggins supporters say the vote went their way in part because 3 years have passed since the marriage ruling. Back at the evangelical gathering, activist Barb Hecke agrees time wasn't on their side as they tried to vote Wiggins off the bench.
Well, obviously I'm disappointed because he was one of the seven. And I think if he'd been up for retention back then, they all seven would have been voted out.
Which raises the question of what will likely happen when three more justices involved in the marriage ruling come up for retention in 2016. The justices' supporters say they don't expect they'll have to wage a battle again, but they say they're ready if they have to. In Des Moines, I'm Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio News.
In Missouri, Democratic Governor Jay Nixon and Republican Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder won re-election, as did Democratic U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill. She defeated Republican Congressman Todd Akin. His campaign faltered after he made boneheaded remarks about rape. Voters in the Avon and Abingdon school districts overwhelmingly approved a merger of the two districts. They also selected members for the new district school board. The Illini West bond issue for building a new high school was rejected, with 63% of voters opposed. Electric aggregation was approved in every single Western Illinois community that put it on the ballot. The biggest margin was in Beardstown, where 94% of the voters cast ballots in favor of it. A concealed carry referendum was on the ballot in four Western Illinois counties, McDonough, Schuyler, Warren, and Adams. It easily won approval in each county. More than 100 people turned out on November 19th for an invitation-only groundbreaking just south of Weaver as work gets underway to build Iowa Fertilizer Company's new production plant. On hand were Governor Terry Branstad and Asif Sawiris, who heads IFC's parent company. Sawiris says Lee County was selected because of transportation access and Iowa's work ethics and values. He tried to alleviate some of the concerns of the plant's potential neighbors.
Iowa Fertilizer Company will use state-of-the-art technology to ensure it will be the safest and most efficient plant in the United States.
The new plant is expected to create 2,500 construction jobs, 165 full-time jobs at the facility, and 700 supplemental jobs. Roquette America must pay a $4.1 million civil penalty to settle allegations it dumped industrial waste into the Mississippi River and Soap Creek. Public Radio's Jason Parrott has that story from November 13th.
The EPA says the company has known for years that the wastewater treatment plant at its grain processing facility in Keokuk could not handle spills or surges. But instead of addressing the plant, the EPA says industrial waste was allowed to discharge directly into the two waterways. EPA Region 7 Administrator Carl Brooks says the magnitude of these violations warrants the magnitude of the penalty. The agency says Roquette has violated its own discharge permit more than 1,100 times and has released at least 250,000 gallons of industrial waste. The company must also invest more than $17 million in programs and projects aimed at protecting the two waterways. A statement from Roquette acknowledges the consent decree and settlement of permitting-related issues, but there is no mention of the civil penalty or the repeated violations cited by the EPA. I'm Jason Parrott.
The U.S. EPA says the evidence is clear. The Earth's climate is changing. Global temperatures could rise to levels not seen for at least 2 million years. Earth's average temperature is expected to rise 2 to 11 degrees during the next 100 years. Dr. Eric Grimm of the Illinois State Museum has studied the climate and spoke about it as part of the second Sunday Science series at Dixon Mounds Museum. He says you cannot ascribe a single storm, such as Hurricane Sandy, to climate change.
But what you can say is that the frequency of such storms has increased, the power of such storms has increased. I mean, here we had a 1,000-mile-wide storm in November. And so the probability is that, yes, that can be ascribed to global climate change.
Why do you think it's taken so long, I guess, for the public to come around on this? You pointed to a statistic that 68% of Americans now see climate change as a serious problem. It's taken a while to get a majority of Americans to see things this way.
The events of this last couple of years, with the tremendous droughts in the southern plains last year, tremendous drought this year in the Corn Belt, Illinois, Midwest, this year has focused people's attention on it. I think the hurricane, of course, focused people's attention on it. And by the way, sea level rise is already becoming a concern along the East Coast. And in fact, some places, sea level rise doesn't rise the same speed everywhere because you've got land going up and down due to geological forces. And it's particularly bad south of New York. And so they're already seeing, increased sea level rise there. And like I said, it's increased 8 inches during the 20th century. And so that's enhancing. So even if Storm Sandy were the same intensity of a storm 50 years ago, its effect is going to be greater because of the sea level rise.
You mentioned that greenhouse gases increase temperatures, and increased temperatures lead to more greenhouse gases. It's kind of a vicious cycle, isn't it?
It's a vicious cycle, or what we call positive feedback. And the one I discussed in my talk, because it's the easiest to explain, but it has to do with the melting of the Arctic permafrost, which stores huge amounts of carbon. And when that melts, it decomposes first in the methane and then in the carbon dioxide. So as the Arctic is warming, and we're seeing the greatest warming globally is in the Arctic, and as the Arctic is warming, the permafrost is melting, and that is releasing methane and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So it's a vicious cycle, positive feedback, yes.
And you mentioned there's a possibility, or at least a concern, a worry, that perhaps you could have some huge methane burp, I guess, for lack of a better description?
Yeah, that's something that's just started to be looked at right now. There's something called clathrates, which are methane compounds that are stored in the Arctic shelf. And most of the clathrates in the ocean are kept in that form by pressure, ocean pressure. And, of course, rising sea level will increase that pressure and make it less likely. But in the Arctic, they're at shallow depths, and increasing temperature of the Arctic Ocean, enhanced by the melting of the Arctic ice cap, Arctic sea ice, could potentially cause the methane to be released from these clathrates. And there's a huge amount of methane involved there. And so this is something, as I said, this is something we don't know. Is this a danger right yet? It's just really people have just sort of started to focus on it recently and started to do research on it. But it's something that we need to really keep our eye on and consider.
What would happen if there was a huge release of methane all at once?
Well, when it's happened in the past, there have been tremendous global warming incidents with extinction of species around the world and so on.
Well, if you could advise the president regarding climate change and maybe some changes that need to be made, are there one or two things you would tell him?
A lot more research investment into alternative energy, first and foremost, I think. And that includes wind, that includes solar. It may be things like tidal. There are other things out there, you know. I also think that we probably need to look at nuclear as a short-term solution, and maybe more investment in fusion energy. That always seems to be 50 years in the future, but would it be if we had a Manhattan Project for it? You know, I don't know. So we need to do that. Other short-term, I mean, there are other things that are happening which I think are, in spite of what any politician is doing or not doing, is that we're seeing a shift to natural gas production, and I think some of these coal jobs are being lost because of the shift to natural gas. Now, natural gas is a fossil fuel, but it doesn't produce as much carbon dioxide per BTU of power. So it is a cleaner fuel in that sense.
Dr. Eric Grimm of the Illinois State Museum says Western Europe and the U.S. are beginning to reduce fossil fuel consumption, but China and India continue to build new coal power plants and emit more greenhouse gases. Those who want to raise chickens within Macomb city limits hoped the city council would go along with the idea. Instead, the plan laid an egg. The proposal presented to aldermen on November 26th was fairly stringent. The minimum lot size allowed would have been 6,000 square feet. Residents would be allowed no more than 4 chickens and no roosters, and there would be an annual permit fee. Nonetheless, most aldermen squawked about it. The Third Ward's Lou Gilbert said the city was headed down a slippery slope.
We opened its door, and the next thing you know, it's pot-bellied pigs, llamas. Now's the time to stop that, right now.
Fifth Ward Alderman Dave Dorsett said the only people who contacted him about the idea opposed it. He suggested there was an option for those who want to raise chickens while living in or near Macomb.
We have got all kinds of property in the mile and a half that's properly zoned for this. If you're looking for a little more independence and a little more adherence to the land, then that perhaps is the best place to purchase property.
Sixth Ward Alderman Tim Lobdell raised concerns about enforcement.
We have a lot of ordinances on the books that we have a hard time enforcing, and we only do so in cases where there's a complaint. And this is going to be yet another complaint-driven system.
Second Ward Alderwoman Kay Hill also opposed the idea.
I think there's just a trend. You know, this is kind of a groovy thing to do, and having organic eggs isn't really the primary endeavor.
But Macomb resident Dan Barkley said it's not just a fad or a trend.
I appreciate reference to people who want chickens being groovy. I think that all the people in the cities that do have ordinances that allow chickens include quite a few people who aren't groovy.
Barkley was one of three members of the public who spoke in favor of the idea. He also countered the suggestion this would open the door for other animals in the city.
Slippery slope is a very typical argumentative fallacy. I mean, we get chickens, the next thing we're going to have is goats. The next thing we're going to have is cattle. The next thing we're going to have is whales. It makes no sense. Just say no to the next animal you don't want.
The only alderman who supported the proposal is the 7th Ward's Clay Hinderleiter, who poked a couple holes in the arguments against the plan.
Noise. Roosters. Come on, guys. We've got 38 trains that go through this town every day. Don't like it, move.
That's a great way to build a community.
Hinderleiter hoped chickens would be allowed again and had already started preparing to raise some at his home. Those plans will have to be set aside, though. A clear majority of the council agreed chickens should not come home to roost in Macomb. A Western Illinois University biologist is turning heads in the science teaching world. He's written a compelling piece about the function of the pituitary gland. It's a true story about himself. Public Radio's James Needham told us about him on the final day of November.
Eric Ribbon stands out in a crowd. He's 6'6" with broad shoulders. He wears size 18 shoes.
There are advantages to being big. I can tell my class to pipe down and focus, and generally people pay attention to me. I don't worry too much about walking down a street at night.
But there are drawbacks, too.
There are times when I wonder what it's like to be normal. And it can be wearying that people immediately focus on that difference instead of the fact that I'm just another person.
But being different is nothing new to Ribbons. As a child, he was often sick and developed knee problems. He also became sluggish at Little League practice. What they found was a tumor pushing on his pituitary gland. Doctors used radiation to kill the tumor and, as it turns out, the entire gland. That's no small detail. The pituitary gland regulates growth in adolescence. So to compensate for its loss, doctors started Ribbons on hormones, leading to his growth spurt. Despite the physical challenges he battled as a child, Ribbons is a cheerful, friendly man. He jokes about his disdain for country music and boasts that it's his daughter's birthday. He beams in a similar way when he talks about his students. It's that love for teaching that inspired Ribbons to share his story.
It was an uncomfortable thing to write because it shares so much about me. And it gets into some subjects which are not necessarily things you really want to be talking with your students about. However, it is a story that resonates with people.
The case study is called Chemical Eric. It follows his life from some of his first memories. It uses personal details to describe what it was like when he noticed a problem with his pituitary function. He felt sick, and his rapid physical development led him to become shy and quiet. Chemical Eric was published in a collection at the National Center for Case Study Teaching and Science, which means it can be used to teach budding young scientists across the nation. Dr. Kip Herod, who founded the center, says Chemical Eric has an angle that not too many publications can compete with.
What makes it appealing is the fact that it deals with him personally. It's not just a person that is just telling a story about somebody else. The person that's writing it is talking about himself. That's a kind of personal engagement that is hard to top.
Herod is not the only one that likes the story. Readers of the Journal of College Science Teaching chose Chemical Eric as the second favorite case study out of 450. The story also made a particularly strong impression on one of Ribbon's own pre-med students.
It suddenly occurred to her that patients are not just syndromes to be treated, but they're people. It really affected her to realize the implications, the results of what everything had done to me, to talk to me. She came to me later and she said, "Well, I'm really sorry to hear that you've had such a miserable life," which was kind of an overreaction. I like my life.
Ribbon's health today is generally stable, but there are still a few challenges. He compares it to parents teaching their child how to ride a bicycle.
My doctors are running along on one side, propping me up, and on the other side, propping me up. We keep monitoring my hormones and so forth and adjusting as necessary.
While doctors help prop up Chemical Eric, he returns the favor. It seems scientists around the country love a fellow scientist's firsthand account of what a patient is experiencing. I'm James Needham.
The railroads were once considered cutting-edge technology, and a historian credits them with helping to shape Illinois. Public Radio's Scott Stuntz talked to him last month.
That historian is Simon Cordry. He chairs Western Illinois University's Department of History. He says much of Illinois had not yet been settled when rails began crisscrossing the state in the mid-1800s.
Illinois was essentially a wilderness. It was the frontier. When the Illinois Central Railroad sent out surveyors to map out where their line was going to go in 1851 and 1852, there are numerous examples of these surveyors being attacked by wolves. This really was the frontier.
People now tend to think of railroads as sort of antiquated and something very outdated. What did people, you know, think of railroads? What were they like in the popular imagination?
People in the 19th century saw the railroad in the same way that we would have seen the space program, the moonshot program in particular, in the 1960s, and the same way that we look at the internet today. It's the technology of the future.
One of the contrasts between some of those technologies and this is some of the characters in these stories aren't the most scrupulous people, and maybe could you take us through some examples of that sort of Wild West aspect of it.
A prime example of what I think we could call cowboy capitalism, with the idea that it's out of control, is Henry Dwight Jr. Henry Dwight Jr. was a New York banker who was asked by the president of the Alton and Sangamon Railroad, a man by the name of Godfrey. Benjamin Godfrey said to Henry Dwight Jr., "Can you help me raise money?" And Henry Dwight Jr. recognized that here was, to be blunt, a mark. And so he convinced the Alton and Sangamon to turn over everything to him to enable him to pillage and plunder the railroad for his own ends. And he did so, I mean, by any standards, he did so magnificently. Henry Dwight Jr. had his own appointees on the board of directors, and that enabled him to raise money to repay personal loans. He used company collateral for his own use. He would pocket insurance payouts that were supposed to go to the victims of train wrecks. He would do all sorts of nefarious things in order to benefit himself and his closest friends. And there are lots of examples of that kind of, frankly, completely unscrupulous and totally immoral and borderline illegal by the standards of the time, activities. But when you look closely enough, you could argue that many of the better known railroad entrepreneurs also, like the best professional athletes, pushed themselves close to the edge of the law to find out what they could get away with. So I think that Henry Dwight Jr. is an extreme example, but certainly not the only example. The Illinois Central was trying to build into Chicago, and in order to do so, it had to cross the existing tracks of an Indiana railroad, the Indiana Northern. The Indiana Northern didn't want the Illinois Central to do that. And so the Illinois Central Railroad simply went ahead on a cloudy, moonless night, the Illinois Central kidnapped the guards who the Indiana Northern had set up, and they just slapped down a rail. They crossed the other railroad and made their way into Chicago. And the consequence was, of course, deadly, because the two companies ignored each other. And in 1853, two trains smashed into each other and 18 people were killed and 40 or so injured.
So let's say, you know, the railroad stopped working. Would we notice pretty quickly?
We would notice immediately, absolutely. One of the other commodities that railroads carry is oil. And so, for example, oil that's being produced in the United States, much of it travels by pipeline, but there's still a significant share that travels by railroad. So we would notice at the gas pump, I imagine within a matter of weeks, were the railroads to stop running.
Simon Cordry chairs the Department of History at Western Illinois University. He says unlike our current rail system, the state and federal governments did not have the power to regulate commerce or safety laws during the rail industry's early days. He says it was only thanks to court cases launched in Illinois that those rules were eventually upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Scott Stuntz.
November 11th was not ideal for doing anything outdoors in Keokuk. The sky was overcast, the temperature was dropping, and the wind was whipping. But the weather did not stop more than 70 people from celebrating Veterans Day at the Keokuk Veterans Memorial. Public Radio's Jason Parrott was in attendance and sent this audio postcard.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this Veterans Day 2012.
A veteran is a fellow citizen, an ordinary person who at one significant point in his or her life made out a blank check payable to the United States of America for any amount up to and including life itself.
This is the first Veterans Day since the end of World War I where there are no American surviving veterans of that war.
Americans who stepped out of the crowd and swore an oath to support and defend our Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies. Each of the men and women we honor today utter the words of that soldier's oath.
Through the centuries, America has been a symbol to the world, a symbol of higher ideal. Millions of people around the globe still look to America for the hope and promise of something better.
On Veterans Day, we come together as a nation to thank our veterans for their service and let them know that their sacrifices will never be taken for granted.
And to the families, a special word of thanks for the support they have provided during the good times as well as the bad. They too have served their country well.
Now comes the part of the ceremony where we remember all those who have lost their lives in the service of our country.
Let us all go from this place with heads held high, spirits lifted, and pride in our hearts for what our veterans have done to preserve the land of the free and the home of the brave. I say thank you.
Public Radio's Jason Parrott produced that audio postcard from the November 11th Veterans Day ceremony at the Keokuk Veterans Memorial. That concludes In the Tri-States. Thanks to Jason Parrott, Scott Stuntz, James Needham, and Joyce Russell for their contributions. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Egger.